non-constituency-based body that is appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. We have 7 commission members. They are required by statute to represent both the geographic diversity and a partisan diversity, so we cannot have more than 4 members representing 1 political party. We have 1 vacancy right now, but the governor will have a nominee to fill that vacancy in the near future. We have 12 staff positions with an 11.5 FTE, and they are in 2 program units. One is the Criminal Justice Commission, which is the planning, research, data analysis, sentencing guidelines, and forfeiture oversight, and that is half the FTE, but about 5% of the budget. And Juvenile Crime Prevention, which administers both state and federal juvenile crime prevention grants and performs related activities. That's, again, half the other, 6 positions in our budget, but 95% of the funding. On page 3 of the handout, I've shown you our organization chart. The non-shaded positions are those that are in the Criminal Justice Commission program unit. They basically serve to perform the agency administrative functions, provide research and analysis, and administer the felony sentencing guidelines program. The shaded positions are those in the juvenile crime prevention unit, where we have a program coordinator, 2 contract monitors, a program technician, and 2 clerical positions to support those functions. Our major functions are listed on page 4 of your handout. Our primary duty by statute is to develop a state criminal justice policy and long-range public safety plan. Our first report to the governor and legislature is on your desks, and we'll be talking about that a little more later. Most of our funding and positions are organized in the Criminal Justice Commission program unit are organized around supporting the felony sentencing guidelines program, and we'll get into that in a little more detail later. We analyze felony sentencing trends and other criminal justice data. We provide staff to what is now a constitutionally required oversight body for asset forfeiture. You'll see us more at the end of the session when you do crime-related bills, because we develop the corrections fiscal impact estimates, so you know how much the policy committees is going to cost in terms of corrections and supervisions costs. And we serve as more or less a gateway for interested parties into public safety system, both state and local, and for people who have questions about data or how things work in the system. We're typically one of the first ports of call for people starting to inquire about that, and then we can refer them on to other agencies or answer their questions directly. Again, the second program unit is juvenile crime prevention. We have both the state general fund grants, which are given to counties. We also administer the juvenile crime prevention grants from the Federal Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. Those were transferred to the commission last session to coordinate and support the high-risk juvenile crime prevention grants that you authorized. We have a variety of related functions. That federal money comes with some strings. We have to report on juvenile detention activities, whether juveniles are being held in adult correctional facilities, and several other requirements, so we do some monitoring and regulatory duty in that area as well. As Larry mentioned, I think the key budget issues this time, one is funding for the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee. In previous sessions, that has been the direction of this committee and the body generally, that be a self-supporting function, in that we get a small percentage, 2.5% to 3% of the forfeiture proceeds as they are conducted by state and local law enforcement agencies, and that has funded the oversight function for the last 4 years. With passage of Measure 3, many agencies are at least temporarily pulling the plug on forfeiture activities. We don't have any financial reports yet. They're due on April 20, but we're expecting a dramatic reduction of the money there, so we're going to have to work with you to figure out how we're going to pay for that activity until we have a little better idea of what kind of revenue we might expect on the other fund side. The other issue that we've talked with this committee about, both during the regular sessions and the interim, is resources to fulfill our statutory obligation to do public safety planning. When the commission was created in 1995, we maintained most of the duties that the Criminal Justice Council had, but those studies and recommendation areas were wrapped in the context of a long-range plan. And when the commission was created, we actually lost 1 FTE, and the budget was never really structured to support a planning function. And so I'm happy to tell you that the governor has approved a new position that would provide some direct support for that function where the commission can take a more active role in looking at how the pieces of the system fit together and make some recommendations, more specific recommendations on to enhance the efficiency and effectiveness of the system overall and not just piece by piece.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Troll.
How did you manage to produce this impressive looking document here?
We filled it full of blank pages. Basically what we did was took staff away from their other duties, and I'll talk a little more about that. But that is what we found both in we have both, on my commission, we have people who are both what I would say lay members, just citizens, as well as people who have had some role in the public safety system. And as we started to talk about what kind of plan we wanted to produce, we just found that so many people didn't understand a lot of even basics on who does what the cities generally do, how they fund their activities, what counties do, what their relationship is with the state, how the federal government plays into this. And so what you have before you is primarily a profile of the adult criminal justice system, where we try to just explain how things work, introduce people to terminology, talk about what the relationships are between the various government entities, and we did make a few recommendations on changes this body could consider this session to get us moving forward, but to kind of set the stage for what we'd like to get to, and I think what I'm sure you would like to see is how we look at this as a system instead of a conglomerate of 200 and some different law enforcement agencies and different county bodies. And
so with some improvement in staff, you'll have a more detailed plan.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. What we've been able to do is basically held a series of public hearings, gotten the agencies to come in and talk about what they see as the important issues. In our statute, we have a series of statutorily required areas to make recommendations in terms of how we use corrections facilities, how community corrections programs are being implemented, what we can do to reduce future criminal conduct. And so we've taken a kind of gathered that and inventoried it and packaged it for you and for us. And then the next step will be to take a little more in-depth look. But in order to do that effectively and to answer some of the questions I'm sure you have, we've just been kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul. And so I was very happy to see the governor's approved a position so we can really devote some time and have someone take the lead in that and really have the time to spend in working on the issue. On page 5, I want to talk a little bit about our goals and strategies. Obviously, since our by statute our primary responsibility is to do a public safety long-range public safety plan for Oregon, that is our first goal, and our strategy again is to get the staff that we need to really do justice to that task. Second is to improve the felony sentencing data. One of the trade-offs in preparing this report for you has been that we have not had the time and effort that we need to devote to maintaining the quality of the felony sentencing data. We have a couple of the larger counties who are not sending in their statutorily required sentencing reports at all, and so we do have some holes that we don't want to have any bigger in what data we're able to provide you and tell you about people who are sentenced for felonies in Oregon. We've had some between staffing problems and turnover, we're behind on our data entry in that area, and we really need to make a concerted effort to make sure that we have quality information to provide to you and can give you an accurate picture of how felony sentencing works in Oregon. Third goal is to continue to reduce juvenile crime and the victims of juvenile offenders. We're asking to do that by maintaining the current service level funding as best we can for the juvenile crime prevention grants. And then finally, to improve the knowledge and understanding of Oregon's public safety system, again, by working on this plan and continuing our efforts to develop and disseminate accurate public safety data. On page 6, on major programs, changes and reorganizations, again, I mentioned that in 1995 was when the commission was created, replacing the Criminal Justice Council. We maintain most of the duties in that from that body, but the specific study areas and recommendations were wrapped up in the context of a long-range plan, and the FTE from the council to the commission was reduced by one. In 1997, we were directed to provide staff to the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee, and that function is performed by a 0.5 FTE research analyst, again, which is other funded. In 1999, we picked up a major new responsibility that...
Chair. When you were directed to provide the staff, did the legislature provide you with that half FTE to do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Troll, Yes, is the short answer. What we did was, the position that was cut in 1995 was a clerical position, so we had absolutely no clerical support, and that person was the one who entered all the sentencing data that came in from the counties. So for 2 years, we were kind of flying blind in terms of not being able to tell you what was going on for felony sentencing. So in order to restore that position, we reduced the research analyst position that we're talking about here to halftime. And then when the legislature was looking at reinvigorating the forfeiture oversight function, they added that to my shop and then gave us the other funds authority to fund that. So we picked up that additional responsibility. It reduced our analytical capacity somewhat, but it's and again, anytime you have a startup function, it just, you're starting a big rock and pushing it uphill. So that did take a lot of time, but we did get the staff and the funding to do that. Again, in 1999, we picked up the responsibility to administer juvenile crime prevention grants. That was obviously a significant change for us, going from a planning and research body to a grant administration body. We have two advisory committees that we provide staffing for, one which deals with the federal grants. It's statutorily required by the federal government to do the planning and distribute the federal juvenile crime prevention grants. And then we have the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee, which was established by statute last session, and which is why Representative Canope just came in, because he's one of the legislative members of that committee.
Mr. Chair, who had administered the federal juvenile crime prevention grants before you took the responsibility?
Mr. Chair, Senator Truro, those were at the Commission on Children and Families. And as one of the things that Senate Bill 555 did last session was try to make a targeted effort to deal with adolescent kids who are at risk of getting involved or further involved in the juvenile justice system. And those federal grants are juvenile crime prevention grants that had been used for that population. And so that function was transferred to the Criminal Justice Commission as the new high-risk juvenile crime prevention partnership was established.
From your vantage point, has it worked well?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think so. It's allowed the Commission on Children and Families to focus their efforts on the younger age kids. It's given us some additional ability to, as we look at the general fund juvenile crime prevention grants, it gives us the ability to move those into a support position, and we're trying to use those as more of a systems catalyst for system change rather than just program funding. So we have made some changes in how we've used that money, but in my view, that's worked very well. And I do. If you do have more specific questions, we can deal with those tomorrow, or Becky Eklund, who is the Juvenile Crime Prevention Coordinator in my office, is here to answer questions as well if you have more. And then in 2001, we have asked for two changes in existing staff positions to give us the increased financial accountability and oversight of those grant functions. One of the things that we learned, obviously, that in taking on $19 million in grant distributions takes a little different administrative requirements than you do when you're a small agency with $1.5 million budget and limited funding sources. So we're asking to restructure that so we can process those and keep better track of them. On performance measures on page 7, we are still developing our performance measures, and they have not been adopted by the Commission. As we go through some of the program areas, I will talk about what we're looking at and discussing in terms of program measures, but we have not got to the point where we have formally adopted them. We have been consulting with the Progress Board, and I would say that they've been helpful in kind of refining our thinking and giving us some guidance, since they work with so many agencies on those type of issues.
Chair.
Senator Truro.
Yesterday, when we were talking to Mr. Tryons, he mentioned that there's one fairly important benchmark for which no agency apparently takes the lead, and that has to do with the number of kids packing weapons to schools. It makes sense to have your agency take the lead in that. We thought about the Department of Ed as perhaps the lead agency, but who should be the lead agency?
Mr. Chair, Senator Truro, I can't tell you off the top of my head. There are several agencies that deal with schools and violence in schools. Department of Ed has a federal grant stream that they have for school safety planning. As you know, the Attorney General's Office and Department of Justice just issued a report on school safety, so I don't know if they would have an interest in doing that. Most of the risk factors that we have in statute are based on academic performance and school failure rather than school safety. And so, in my mind, that's probably not the best fit for us, but it's because we don't deal with actual weapons issues. But certainly, we would be interested in that and participating in it. But as far as the lead, I'm not sure that we'd be the best agency to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The primary benchmarks that we do have a relationship with are those that deal with the risk factors that are targeted in our juvenile crime prevention grant stream, those being percentage of eighth grade students who use alcohol or illicit drugs during the previous month, the juvenile arrest rate in Oregon, which is one of the primary measurements of the success that we're hoping to have and continue in the juvenile crime prevention grants, and also benchmark number 65, which is the measurement for juvenile recidivism. The secondary benchmarks that we have a relationship to but don't have a significant direct effect on is the high school dropout rate, again, because school failure is one of the key measurements that we have when the risk factors that we use in identifying these high-risk kids, and also benchmark 64, which is the adult felony recidivism measurement. On page 8, on steps taken to control costs.
Sure.
Senator Crowell.
You say you're developing these performance measures, so when will they be developed and put in place?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crowell, I would like to say we have them done already. We will have them done by the next time you see us. I hadn't really put them into a work plan yet to see when we can reasonably expect to do those. I think really we're one of the things we need to do, especially in the grant administration area, is to look at what other agencies do and how they measure their performance and efficiency, so we're not reinventing the wheel on that stuff. And then when you do kind of amorphous things like planning, we found it real difficult to really hit the nail on the head and how you measure your performance and effectiveness on that. So we still have some work to do on some of the other program areas. I think we are very close and do have pretty concrete and good measurements of how we're doing things. But as a whole, I'd say we still have some work to do on some of the larger ones. On steps taken to control costs, one of the issues for us is trying to consolidate our office staff. When we picked up the juvenile crime prevention responsibilities, we were not able to find office space to house the entire agency. So we have two offices with six people in each. That creates some redundancy because you have to have separate copiers and fax machines, and it's also created some redundancy in that you have two people making purchase orders and things like that. In terms of cost savings, it doesn't make an awful lot of difference, but in terms of just efficiency and coordination, it has caused some problems, and we're continuing to look at how we can consolidate our offices. We looked around during the interim. There is not a lot of space in state-owned buildings. Anytime you go out of state-owned buildings, your costs go up substantially. So we're going to keep an eye out for that. We think it'd be a real efficiency measure that we can obtain. It would help us as an agency, but in terms of the money, we don't have it right now if we're going to move off the state campus. We also hired an organizational consultant to review our administrative structure. Again, this was part of the kind of the growth pains involved in the juvenile crime prevention programs and the grant administration. He came in and reviewed how we're set up and made some of the recommendations, again, that result in the position reclassifications we'll be talking to you about later, and also noted the importance of having a consolidated office space to get us all together. We've held positions vacant until this administrative review was done, and partly because as the juvenile crime prevention grants were phased in over time, we did not have an immediate need for the second grant monitor position, so we held that position vacant. And lastly, we've been involved in supporting the judicial department in developing a uniform sentencing judgment. What that does for the judicial department is get them better data and consistent data and transferring it all electronically. It has the same benefits for the Department of Corrections and also gives them sentencing orders that are legible and understandable in a uniform format, and also transfers that to them electronically. It has similar benefits for us in that rather than requiring hard copy reports from either the court or the prosecutor's offices, we will start getting that information electronically. So we are very favorable toward that and hope that you continue to support development of that project. That has just been rolled out, I believe, in Josephine County, and they are looking to expand that gradually, but we see that as a real benefit, both in terms of the data quality that we will get, and also the, reduces the intermediate step of having to prepare a hard copy report and then enter that into a database, so we would be much more efficient in transmitting that information and get it back to you on a timely basis. On coordinating with related programs, our primary effort in that relates to the Juvenile Crime Prevention Program. And one of the chief benefits of Senate Bill 555 that was passed last session was directing counties to develop a single comprehensive plan for children and families in that county. The high-risk juvenile crime prevention plan that we deal with is a segment of that plan. And then Senate Bill 555 directed the state agencies who are partners or participants in those areas to get together and talk about how we can consolidate and coordinate the planning requirements and the evaluation activities. And so we spent a significant amount of time working at both the state and local level to try to make that happen. The uniform sentencing judgment obviously has as a coordination issue. And then the other thing I would say is that when we have as we continue to increasingly set public safety policy through the ballot box and through the initiative measures, one of the things that that does is it dramatically changes the environment in which that policy discussion occurs. And so we have groups asking multiple agencies on what's going to happen to you if this measure passes. And so what we found is it's been very beneficial to have, for example, with the proposal to repeal Measure 11, which was ballot Measure 94 in the last election ballot. We had people coming in on a regular basis asking the OIA one question, asking DOC another question, asking us yet another question. And so we found it was very beneficial to all of us to get together and kind of sit down and map that out and see whose data tells what, so we can give people some meaningful and reliable information and not have all these ad hoc requests coming in all the time.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Crow.
What is a uniform sentencing judgment? What does that mean?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow. Right now, in most counties, when a judge imposes a sentence on a person, they do that on a piece of paper that can take a variety of formats. It can have different information on it. And when you get those things, either when we get them at the commission for our sentencing.
Is that called a judgment?
Yes. That is the legal document that, for example, transfers legal custody of that person to the Department of Corrections or to the supervisory authority at the county level. And so when we get it, if we don't get our sentencing form, we ask for a copy of the judgment. And because there are multiple circuit judges sitting in one county, every judge wants it a little different, wants it to look a certain way. When we get those, just to find the name and the identification number and what the charge was and the conviction and the actual time served, it's all in a different place and shown in a different way. And so what the uniform sentencing judgment is to automate that process to make sure we have all the essential information and data elements, both for our purposes and for the custody purposes of the Department of Corrections, in a format that they can easily find and identify. And so it, again, the judge can have it print out and look however way the judge wants it, but in terms of electronic transmission of that data, it comes to us in formats that we can identify and plug into our own systems and automate it instead of having to do the hand search.
Thank you. That's
the other thing I would add is that Department of Corrections often, I shouldn't say often, but sometimes gets what they call a note from mother, you know, please lock up Johnny for a period not to exceed 10 years and then sentencing judgment to follow. And so we believe that this kind of a system obviously will give us better quality and more timely responses in that area as well. On administrative costs, this again is something that is changing over time as we dramatically change our functions. We took a quick look and included the supervisory, payroll, personnel, budgeting, and financial transaction activities, and all clerical activities except the sentencing guidelines data entry. It does not include the special payments for grants or the evaluation services that we contract for, and that total amounts to approximately 2.2% of our 0103 budget. On our information technology, there's not an awful lot of remarkable things there. We obviously use it to receive, analyze, and disseminate public safety data, and in the typical administrative sense in terms of email and some of those activities. We do have a website that we just started up earlier this year that we hope will be very useful in disseminating public safety data. We put our asset forfeiture activities on there, information on the juvenile crime prevention grant process, and the public safety plan when we're in the process of transferring that to HTML format. That will go on the website. We also just do some basic crime data so people can see the reports and arrests within their counties, whether crime has gone up or down in Oregon, and various ways of looking at that, and just provide some basic public safety data for the citizens of the state. In terms of connecting with other agencies, we do get some sentencing data transmitted electronically from local jurisdictions, and again, with the Uniform Sentencing Judgment, we hope to continue that and expand it. We have electronic access to OJIN, which is the court's judicial information system. We use that to verify and validate some of the sentencing data that we get. We periodically get data sets from other agencies for analysis, and that includes LEDS records from the state police and corrections admissions data. And I serve on the Criminal Justice Information Standards Advisory Board, so we do have some participation and link in the larger public safety data planning that occurs at the state level. In terms of the other IT questions we were asked to address, we don't really have a lot to report there. We have some minor programming changes in our databases, which we use to track the juvenile crime prevention grants, and in our felony sentencing data analysis, we periodically update and replace our obsolete personal computers. We do not have any substantial IT contracts. And online services, again, that's primarily information that we receive through the sentencing guidelines and forfeiture reporting process, and then our website to disseminate that information out. On page 10, I provided a list of some of the budget-related policy legislation, and we have quite a few of those this session. Some of those you will see, and others I'm not sure if they will come down here or not. I've marked the major ones in bold type, but just want to mention a couple of them. House Bill 2082 has passed the House. It is looking at using some of the federal juvenile crime prevention grants to support community learning centers through schools. It basically directs the Commission and Department of Education and a couple other agencies to support development and implementation of those centers and work with LFO to identify resources that have been committed through the current process to fund those centers. It doesn't have any immediate budget impact, but we're being looked at as a funding source for those activities.
What is a community learning center?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, as I understand it, it is a school-based referral service for community programs. Different communities operate them in different ways, but it is basically kind of a one-stop shopping for troubled kids. And so SCF may have an office there, community corrections may, or juvenile parole department may have an office there. It's a way to get the kids in school, find out what services they need, and either provide them at the school or provide a referral system so kids at school know who to call and where to go.
Okay. Are these in every county?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, no. I couldn't tell you exactly how many there are in a state. I think it's more, there's variations on a theme, but basically a few counties have some model of them working, and this legislation, as I understand it, is intended to broaden that system and implement it on a larger scale.
Okay, thank you.
You know who requested that legislation?
I believe, Mr. Chair, is that Representative?
It was a wise judicious piece of legislation that was developed during the interim by myself, Janet Carlson, and Representative Cruz adopted it as the committee bill. There's a lot of these types of learning schools, learning centers there. They come under a lot of different names. Schools for the 21st Century and Sun Schools in Multnomah County, but they've got other names and other makeups, and it's much more permissive. I don't think this is going to change the world dramatically as we know it. It's more of a policy statement that says when these learning centers are available, that we'd like state agencies to look at them and see if this makes sense to do a delivery of service through them. But I don't think we'll. dramatically, although certainly you'd want state agencies to be looking at this because they are a good service delivery model. And they go well beyond troubled kids. They're also, most of them are also trying to get parents involved in the schools, trying to get different types of community services. Some are called lighted schools that try and utilize the school buildings until during non-school hours. But it's more permissive than anything else. That.
Thank you.
Well, I hope I didn't do too much injustice to your concept, Representative.
Probably not.
House Bill 2404 is one of the ones that would have a substantial budgetary impact on the commission. It reestablishes a version of the former Criminal Justice Council. It's about 20-some members. It's a constituency-based body, so we would have a chief and sheriff and legislative members on that group. Directing the council to make recommendations to ensure that criminal justice resources target offenders who present the greatest risk to public safety and those offenders most likely to reoffend. That's pending a work session up in House Judiciary, and it does have a subsequent referral down here, I believe.
Same question as to the source of that legislation?
That's an interim judiciary committee bill.
Thanks.
This new Criminal Justice Council is not going to be part of it exactly, but I'm going to give the staff for it. So it'll be a parallel group to yours doing what?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, again, as I understand the concept, and as Senator Bryan has been the one advancing this, is to the Interim Judiciary Committee spent a fair amount of time talking about not only former Senator Bryant.
He's not around, I guess, to understand our budget constraints.
Well, when he came back and talked to the committee, he said that
usually a fatal flaw.
That he was grateful to still be called senator and that he understood that that was accepted protocol.
Right.
And I said, when I go and I come back, I'll just be the ex-director, not the executive director, so that the titles are a little different. But just to provide a forum to look at how we best target public safety resources, I think, is his intent on that. I haven't spent a lot of time working with him to understand really exactly what he wants to see or how that fits into what other activities we
used to call it the Criminal Justice Council, and it became the commission. Now we're going to have both, council and commission.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, yes.
I just would phrase it as proposed.
Right. You think there's some problem with it?
You know, I mean, we can cut back on those faculty salary increases we heard about yesterday if you want. Proceed, please.
House Bill 2325 has the potential to divert some forfeiture proceeds and establish a new priority that would compete with the existing priorities. That bill has not had a hearing on the House side. House Bill 2429 is the implementing legislation for ballot measure 3 that has passed the House and on its way to the Senate. For the budgetary impact, we obtained an amendment in that bill so that, well, let me back up and give you a very brief explanation. Before Measure 3 passed, the Oversight Committee had responsibility only for drug-related forfeitures. So anytime a drug-related forfeiture occurred, we would get 2.5% or 3% of the proceeds after costs that would fund the oversight activity. Any forfeitures that were done on the basis of drunk driving, driving while suspended, prostitution, and some of the other forfeitures that occur under the authority of local ordinances were not included in our oversight responsibilities, nor did they contribute to funding. Measure 3 says that any civil forfeiture is subject to the committee's oversight. And so what 2429 does is say, to the extent people are doing any civil forfeiture, each of those civil forfeitures has to contribute to the oversight function. So if civil forfeiture comes back because of House Bill 2429, then what we try to do is ensure that there's a broad base so everybody who's subject to oversight also contributes to the oversight funding. House Bill 2421 creates a law enforcement context policy and data review committee to basically look at the two-word summary of that will be racial profiling. You've heard some, I think, about data collection, and several police agencies in the state are voluntarily agreeing to collect data on who they stop and what the results of those stops are. This creates an advisory committee to work with the state and local governments on collecting that data. It is funded through $300,000 in an allocation from the criminal fines and assessment account, and the commission would serve basically as the administrative home for that money, and most of the services in that would be contracted out.
These all interim products?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2441 was a bill sponsored by Representative Walker that originally mandated data collection by all law enforcement agencies and has been modified to set it up this way. The general concept has been around since 1997 when the body passed House Bill 2433, which expanded police officers' ability to stop people and seek consent searches. And there was a data collection component in that. Last session, we came to this committee with recommendations for some funding to formalize the data collection and provide support and assistance for that. And so this is kind of an ongoing outgrowth of that. House Bill 2590 is a bill sponsored by Representative Williams that authorizes the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee to make grants for after-school and mentoring programs. The funding mechanism for that, again, would be an increase in the unitary assessment in the criminal fines and assessment account revenue, and that bill is in House Judiciary. House Bill 3642 authorizes criminal forfeiture, and the distinction being in civil forfeiture, the law enforcement agency files a civil lawsuit where the property is the defendant. In criminal forfeiture, the forfeiture would be a part of the criminal proceeding. And so in its current draft, the Oversight Committee would still be responsible for some reporting and oversight on forfeiture activities, even though done through the criminal side instead of the civil side, and we would receive some funding proceeds from that. So again, to the extent this legislation restores the ability and the willingness of the state and local governments to do forfeitures, we're trying to set up a broad support base for the oversight function so we don't have to use general fund dollars for that. And so that really covers the major budget-related policy legislation. In our affirmative action report, at the time of our most recent report, the commission had 6 positions filled with permanent employees. Of those, none were persons of color and 3 were women. In the 2 filled management positions, we had 1 woman employee and no persons of color, and 2 of the 4 positions, professional position employees, are women and none are persons of color. The organization chart on page...
Okay. You're on, Bill?
I think so, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services, taking you through the governor's recommended budget. The recommendation for the Criminal Justice Commission is a budget of $19.5 million general fund, $23.6 million total fund. That's an increase in total funds of about 25% over the legislatively adopted budget and an 8.2% decrease from the current service level. The budget for the Criminal Justice Commission is about 83% general fund. There's a small amount of other funds that represent asset forfeiture revenues, as Phil's been mentioning. Federal fund sources come from the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Justice Programs for the Statistical Analysis Center. There's a ballot measure 11 impact study that's been ongoing. And as Phil indicated, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention funds are administrated through the juvenile crime prevention piece of the program. As I said, the governor's budget is basically a 25% increase over the legislatively adopted budget. The key components: it increases the general fund for juvenile crime prevention grants by $4.2 million from the legislatively adopted budget. The total of $17.7 million for juvenile crime prevention grants is $2 million below the current service level. Phil indicated the budget establishes a planning position to develop, to assist in the development of the state's public safety plan, the first draft which Phil's delivered to you today. And the budget modifies staffing to increase fiscal and accounting expertise. The governor's revised budget funds the race-based policing studies with criminal fines and assessment account revenues, as Phil has indicated. We had originally presented that to you as part of the Department of State Police budget. Part of the work group around House Bill 2441 recommending that be added to the Criminal Justice Commission budget. So you're seeing us asking you to move that here. Two program units here again. The Criminal Justice Commission activities are about 5% of the funding for the agency. The Juvenile Crime Prevention is about 95% of the funding. The budget is primarily special payments. over 90%. The juvenile crime prevention grants, Office of Juvenile Justice Delinquency Prevention grants distributed to counties and other local governments. Small amounts for personal services, services supplies, and capital outlay. To the development of the governor's budget, the only emergency board issue is the salary adjustment increases. Current service level issues include position and standard inflationary changes, standard state government service charge adjustments, the phase-in of the juvenile crime prevention grant funding that was established last biennium, reduction in federal grant funds for a study of the impact of ballot measure 11 as that study moves toward completion, and the restoration of a small one-time general fund reduction that was taken by the 99 legislature. In terms of policy packages and the Criminal Justice Commission, Package 90 increases general fund by $4,671 and $5,000 other funds. It abolishes an office manager 2 position and establishes a fiscal coordinator 2 to provide additional fiscal expertise, and increases the other fund's expenditure limitation for the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee, again, assuming that the revenue is there. Package 101, the planner 3 position, $141,422 general fund, 1 position. And this creates a dedicated position to assist in the development and maintenance of the state's public safety plan. The juvenile crime prevention program unit, policy package 90, that's a reduction of basically $2.3 million general fund, reduces the county grants by $2 million below current service level, reduces evaluation funding by half or $250,000, eliminates the juvenile crime prevention startup costs of $3,588, and eliminates a grants coordinator position and establishes an accounting 3 position. There are no roll-ups in this budget for 2003-2005. I think the revenue issue in addition to the asset forfeiture is also the criminal fines and assessment account revenues we're proposing for the race-based policing studies. And the only change to the governor's printed budget, as I mentioned, was the $300,000 for the race-based policing. And that would be my presentation.
Thank you. Bill, you're back on, huh?
Mr. Chair and members, page 12 of my handout is the proposed organization chart. The 3 positions that have been modified in the course of the governor's recommended budget are shaded for you. The planner 3 position is the new one. The fiscal coordinator and accounting tech, as Bill just told you, are abolished and established from current positions, and the net impact, the cost impact of that is about a $12,000 savings in general fund. Again, the reason we're doing that is because we need to have the increased capacity to monitor and process the grant payments and keep track of that money, and we feel that this is the best way to accomplish that.
Sure.
Senator Troll?
Does this proposed organizational chart and the new positions accommodate what you might need in case some of the legislation passes that?
Senator Trone, no. I should say that in terms of something like the Criminal Justice Council, we're going to be asked to do some targeted studies on how criminal justice resources are used and applied. The answer is no, that we would probably require an additional staff person or some resources to accomplish that. If what we're talking about are for example, expanding the grant authority, the JCPAC, to include after-school or mentoring programs, that's a different impact. We haven't spent really the time to go through and understand what depends, obviously, how much money's there and what kind of oversight and criteria the Legislative Assembly expects on those grants. But this does not reflect any of those budget legislation.
I think related to some questions Senator Trove has asked, went back to the changes in the reorganization and the need for this additional person to administer the grants. If you all are seeking additional people for this function, should I assume that I would see a corresponding decrease in the Commission on Children and Families of those positions of people who used to perform this function?
Mr. Chair, no. That was accomplished last session. When the that we received 1.5 positions that were transferred from the Commission on Children and Families to the Criminal Justice Commission. That is a Program Tech 2 and the Halftime Office Specialist 2. Those are split funded between the Federal Juvenile Crime Prevention Grants and General Fund. Both the positions and the funding for those were transferred over. What we're trying to do this session with these abolish and establish positions is we go from an office manager, which is a more of a generalist classification and has payroll, personnel, some accounting and budgeting experience, but it's more of a generalist, and shifting that to a fiscal coordinator, which is a higher level position which more with more direct experience and expertise in accounting and budgeting and financial management. And the other trade-off that we're making is taking one of the grant monitor positions that actually goes out and does some of the inspection and program monitoring out in the field, and shifting that to an accounting tech. So we'll have an increased emphasis on our financial accountability within the juvenile crime prevention area. But there's no, all the funding that on the transfer from the Commission on Children and Families occurred last session. I'm not sure I've answered your question.
Well, you probably have. Was the person who was performing the function before person of these grants unable to do that effectively?
Mr. Chair, it's primarily a workload issue. When we set up the budget in 99, frankly, we didn't adequately prepare for the amount of administrative work it takes to process the money through the system, both on the for the state grants and the federal grants. We thought we could do that with an existing office manager with assistance of a grant coordinator position, and that just hasn't worked out. So we're shifting the expertise that we need to reflect our experience and what kind of help we need to make that program work.
In shifting the expertise, does that result in a higher cost?
Mr. Chair, no.
You have to pay more for this person than you did for the other one?
Well, there are two positions involved. One is an increase and one is a decrease. So I believe the net savings as a result of this is about a $12,000 savings in the next biennium.
The cost is less. Okay.
Proceed. Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Smith.
I'm going to ask a follow-up question, and if I'm off base on this, I do apologize. On the juvenile crime prevention, how come that couldn't be? I need further explanation why that couldn't be administered through Children and Families. As Representative Canope and I were speaking on this, and I guess I need some background on that.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, there are two pieces to the juvenile crime prevention activities. One was a new general fund grant program that was created last session that came to the Criminal Justice Commission. The second piece is about $3.5 million in federal juvenile crime prevention grant funds that were existing in the Commission on Children and Families with 1.5 FTE. That program and funds and positions were transferred from the Commission on Children and Families to the Criminal Justice Commission to coordinate and support a more targeted effort on adolescent kids. The Commission on Children and Families used to have emphasis on 0 to 18. And part of Senate Bill 555 and the policy discussions that they've made have narrowed their focus to kids 0 to 8. And so they wanted to focus more on younger kids, and this didn't really fit in with that program and did fit in with the new...
Children and Families wanted to focus in on 0 to 8.
Yes. And so between that policy decision at their end and the legislature's decision to create a specific grant stream for adolescent kids, primarily, we deal primarily with 10 to 17, the federal grant program fit in more closely with what we were doing and allows us to provide some support and system money for those changes rather than keeping a Commission on Children and Families having to coordinate that function with another agency.
What you were sharing with Chair Miller is that there's a savings then to be had by doing that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I'm not doing a good job answering that question. The two positions that we got from Children and Families are not the two that we're reorganizing now. What we had tried to accomplish last time was to keep our existing administrative structure with an office manager and to use our grant coordinator positions to supplement that in terms of the processing of the grant funds as well as being out in the field and monitoring the activities in the county programs. What we found is that we really had a significant need just to manage the processing of the grant payments both in the state side with the accounting piece and then also the federal reporting on the grant funds. And so we are restructuring just the administrative functions, and are those the two positions that we're talking about on the federal grants are primarily program area and are not really affected by this.
Just follow up statement.
Proceed, please.
One of the concerns I raised with you yesterday in our meeting was, I guess I'm concerned that we're spending time and money completing reports and filling out documents and not spending much of our resources getting into the communities, getting into the programs, and I'm still concerned about that. And as a person that represents a lot of small counties, I hear these stories firsthand and I see them. And, I'm just concerned that we're spending more money than we need to on documenting what we're doing rather than making sure the money's getting to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I'd say a couple things. First of all, the administrative costs in our budget are only about 2.2%, which you've had more experience looking across agencies than I have, but that doesn't seem out of line to me.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Sure.
If you were disbursing twice as much money as you currently forecast you will in 01, 03, would that administrative cost look even less than 2.2?
Mr. Chair, yes, it would.
Because it's just a function here of what your total budget is. I mean, that's, to me, kind of a bogus number. If you had less money to pass out, it would make it look like your administration was less efficient.
That's correct.
I appreciate the,
well, once
the
you set up the system,
but I think it's totally meaningless.
Well, Senator, I would agree that it's a very difficult thing to have on a uniform basis. And I can't tell you with a straight face that I've gone out and looked at how other agencies develop their administrative expenses and what they do and do not include in that. And if there's a standard way of doing that that you'd like us to do, then I'd be more than willing to do
it. I'm not suggesting anything by the comment, but to give us a number of 2.2 and say that we are the most efficient group that's ever been put together.
I would not say
he didn't say that,
efficient.
But I just say that when I read that number, I said, so what? And just is.
Well, in response to Representative Smith's question, what I would say is we're going to have some administrative component no matter what we do. We're not increasing the cost of our administration or our processing costs. We're just trying to restructure the positions that we have to better do that. We're not taking any money out of the grant streams or, you know, and shifting that to the administration side. And so.
Now, my struggle is. Is I'm not seeing the big picture, and I guess I need to do some more homework, because when I go into my smaller counties and I look at children and families and the programs that are being run, I've got an administrator, I've got a secretary, I've got an administrative assistant, and they're dealing with a small amount of dollars. And at some point, I'm concerned that we have more people running the program and not enough money getting into the community. I see the juvenile crime prevention as one component of that, and that's why I'm raising the question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I can just respond to that briefly. I think the issue you're, if I understand it correctly, you're concerned about the local administrative costs and how much the locals are taking for administration as opposed to sending out in programs.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm saying is I've got communities of counties of 1,500 people, and there's three people running a show, and they're dealing with just a couple hundred thousand dollars, and a component of that is this. And at some point, feel like we should be putting more money into the communities and into the programs and into administering them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, one of the things that we've done and that Senate Bill 55 requires us to do is to work with the Commission on Children and Families, the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse, and other agencies that have funds going to the counties for these kids, and to make sure that our planning requirements are aligned as much as we can, to make sure that the evaluation components are aligned as much as we can, and to encourage them to use existing structures to do their plan development. And we've tried to do that in a number of ways. When Professor Fireherm comes in tomorrow to talk to you about some of the juvenile crime prevention evaluation, he'll talk about some of the network analysis and how well groups are working together on that. But in terms of the administrative costs at the local end, we've done, I think, a lot. We can probably do more, but we spend a lot of time working with the local governments to make sure that the planning processes are integrated. And where they have complaints about redundant processes or, you know, how can we tell you the same thing we told them and all that, we take that very seriously and try to coordinate those efforts. The JCPAC fund, or the general fund, grant funds, do have a 15% allotment for local administration. Many counties are not taking up to that level, and we haven't spent a lot of time really reviewing how they're processing that and doing any kind of administrative audit. But just from what we're getting back from the counties and their planning process, is that it's not raising a red flag at this point. And I recognize it's a little different in smaller communities where you don't have a lot of planning and administrative capacity, and you keep kind of getting add-on and have that to deal with. But is that
I'm still frustrated, but your answer does.
If you'd like to deal with that some more, obviously we can be glad to spend that time with you. Mr. Chair, I now intended to go through in a little more detail on some of the Program Unit 1 activities, and then obviously there's a lot of interest in the juvenile crime prevention stuff, but we plan to do most of that tomorrow when we have more folks here to talk to.
Okay.
So to briefly run through, the Program Unit 1 is the everything that is not juvenile crime prevention in the commission budget. It's six FTE positions, about $1.2 million in general fund, about $235,000 in federal funds, and $71,000 in other funds. The major functions that we're talking about are administration of the felony sentencing guidelines. We operate a federal statistical analysis center, which is linked closely with the guidelines program. We have the public safety plan, which is a statutory requirement, forfeiture oversight, and general agency administration. So the biggest activity within that program unit is the administration of the felony sentencing guidelines. We have a half-time clerical position that receives about 14,000 hard copy reports for sentenced felons in the state of Oregon and on it per year, enters those into a database that we then use for research and analysis. We have a full-time research analyst who programs the database that we use and actually conducts the analysis and participates not only in analyzing criminal justice trends, but again, as we do the corrections impact statements on the legislation that's here, we work with that person as the one of the lead people on that as well. Finally, we have a program tech position that is responsible for providing legal and program advice to criminal justice practitioners, whether those are judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, parole and probation officers, people who write the pre-sentence investigation reports, on how they can use the existing laws and rules to structure the sentencing outcomes that they want to get to and make sure that we have some legal consistency in doing that. We also, when the legislature passes new laws creating or modifying felonies, we have to integrate those into the guidelines system through a rulemaking process. Those rules come back to the Assembly every 2 years for ratification, and then we receive, analyze, and disseminate the sentencing data. On performance measures, again, we don't have any formally adopted at this time. What we're looking at are measures of counties that do report. As I mentioned earlier, one of the trade-offs on the public safety plan has been we've not had the attention to go out in the counties and work with the courts and the prosecutor's offices to make sure that we're getting the felony sentencing data that by statute we're supposed to. And we've had some mixed results in going out to non-reporting counties and getting them back in, but we still have more work to do. We have a couple counties, larger counties, who are not reporting at all, and that's obviously something we're very concerned about. Timely data entry has been another issue with staff turnover and not having that position in the 95 biennium. We still have a backlog of data that needs to be entered. We're making a concerted effort to get that done. And then we also want to measure our progress toward electronic data transfer so we can get more efficient and effective in that process as well. Factors affecting services, again, staff turnover has been an issue in this program. In the program coordinator position for the guidelines, I've had three people in that position in the last 2 years. And so that's something I need to spend some time on to just to build the expertise and the continuity so we're not spending an excessive amount of time dealing with new people and training them. And then again, conflicting priorities. I've used the program tech position as the primary person to work on this public safety plan, which takes her away from her guidelines duties. And also, when we do the corrections impact estimates during session, that takes a substantial amount of time. Right now, we're tracking about 300 bills that have some impact either by creating or modifying a felony or doing something with sentencing that requires us, once they get a hearing and or go to work session, that we prepare a corrections impact estimate. Some of those are very simple. Others are very complex. But it's something that this body has spend an increasing amount of time on reviewing and making sure that there are resources for the policy changes you want to do. And so we play a role in developing that and work closely with Mr. Nicewander, Mr. Siebert, and LFO, and the other agencies to give you our best estimate on what kind of a resource impact these changes might have.
You said you're tracking 300? Does that just mean you made a note that they're in the system? At what point do you do your detailed analysis of the impact?
Mr. Chair, the general rule is that LFO likes to have some information available at the first hearing. And so what we've done is talk to judiciary chairs and committee staff and LFO staff to kind of tell them what we can do on a first blush basis. And then once we know kind of if they're really serious in pursuing this and what kind of amendments there might be, we will spend more time doing it. For example, the Senate has passed a bill that it makes it a felony to collect an internet gambling debt using a credit card or a debit card. That is something that we can make a couple phone calls, and you know these places are in the Cayman Islands, and the banks primarily want it just so they have a defense to not pay those things. That's not going to have, you know, prosecutors general are not going to charge that as a felony. It's not going to be enforced. So that's a couple phone calls, and we're done. In contrast, there's a bill that would add into the repeat property offender statute forgery offenses and change some of the criminal history components about who is eligible for these presumptive prison sentences. That is something that we have to spend a fair amount of time on, looking at who is eligible to receive those sentences, contact DAs and judges and practitioners to see how they see this panning out and how often they're going to use it and who they're going to focus on and whether they have the horses to do it and what kind of policy priority they're spending on it. So it can be anything from the sublime to the ridiculous as far as the amount of time it takes. And what we do is just try to keep in contact with LFO staff and the committee staff, so we kind of tell them what we know up front. I call it my bigger than a bread box, because you know the $50,000 is what triggers a referral down here. So what we try to do is just when they get scheduled, you know, there are X number of arrests, here's what we know about forgery convictions, blah, blah, blah. And then once we start getting into the meat of the policy decision with the judiciary committees, then we spend more time developing those.
The trigger is the hearing.
The trigger is the hearing, and then the work session.
You make the first blush. I remember.
Long answer to a short question. I'm sorry.
Well, I remember, Phil, we had, I think it was the Attorney General said they were tracking 4,000 bills. And
it must
as if
everything.
They were reading them. And I got a little concerned about using up all that time for bills that, beyond getting printed, that would be the last they'd ever be heard of or seen or anything. And so it didn't seem to me like a judicious use of time. Yours sounds like a lot better process.
Well, we keep a list, and then again, as they get scheduled for hearing, that's what really, unless we get a request from a member or staff to, you know, tell us, what do you know about this? What do you think would happen? We generally wait until they're scheduled, and then I send just a quick email to the staff and chair saying, here's what we know. This is very big. This is, you know, might need a referral, might not. And just work our way through it.
Just jumping back a little bit here, under services in this presentation here, the legal advice you give to judges would be, for example?
Oh, judge calls up and says, I got a guy in my courtroom who's got these type of convictions. They occurred in two separate episodes. Can I give him this sentence? Or what do I have to do to give him this sentence? And so we would go through the rules and say, well, that you need a departure to do that, and here's the legal findings you need to make. And typically this is the kind of evidence that a prosecutor or defense attorney would bring forth to argue for that change. And how do we get from here to there?
Are you dispensing a lot of legal advice as opposed to advice to prosecutors, defense attorneys, and judges?
Legal advice probably is not the best way to characterize that, Senator.
It's okay.
When prosecutors call up and say, you know, here's what I want to do, what are the steps I have to take under the guidelines to get there, or can I get there? Then we show them the appropriate parts of the statute and the rules.
So you hope your advice is legal, but it's not necessarily legal advice.
When they want legal advice on prosecutors, I generally refer them to the AG's office, so they're getting it from a lawyer who's more certified to deal with them and assist them.
Right.
And if there's an appeal, would be handling it anyway.
Thank you. Representative Hansen, did you wish to be recognized?
Yes.
Anything more?
Quick question. Quick question.
Yes.
The 300 cases, is that a or 300 bills, is that a drop from last session?
Representative Hansen, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
Can't imagine it would be.
We keep very busy.
And you?
Well, we, Mr. Chairman, Representative, we track...
In judiciary last, criminal judiciary last year, we handled that many bills a week.
Probably. Of course, you're right, hearing, so. And Representative Smith?
Thanks, Chairman. Can I go back to the juvenile crime prevention again? Is that all right? In the last biennium, all 36 counties submitted plans to access the grant program. Will they need to create new plans to access future dollars?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the short answer is no. Because we asked them to do a plan update to let us know if there were any changes, substantial changes in either the circumstances in their community or how they wanted to spend the money. But we did not ask them to go through a complete and new planning process to access this money.
What was the cost of each county putting together their plan in the last biennium?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I don't know that we have a figure for you on that. Different counties approached it in different ways. Some had a much broader and collective input and actually had public hearings and went out and visited kids in juvenile detention centers and got a lot of input. Others had a very different planning process, but we didn't ask them to tell us how much they spent on developing the plan.
Would it be possible by tomorrow to get a copy of a grant and program description of what a county would be requested to put together?
Planning guidelines in terms of what we asked them to do? Certainly.
If I was a county and I was going to access the juvenile crime prevention program, what would I need to do to put that together? Thank you.
I can also get you a copy of, would you like a copy of Morrill County's plan to see what they actually submitted and turned into us?
Actually, not Morrill. Can I have Sherman County? I'll take a small county.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Crowe.
Are the grants that you administer competitive grants, or are they grants that counties can qualify if they just meet certain conditions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crowe, the general fund grants are grants that are distributed to every county on the basis of their 0 to 17 population. The federal grants that we administer are based in, we have three separate grant streams within that, and they all are competitive, and that no, they are not entitlement grants. And so once we say that we want to look at system improvements relating to alcohol and drug or violence prevention programs in schools, then we send out the notice, and then local governments and nonprofits can apply for those funds, and then we have a review process that awards the money.
And generally, there's quite a lot of interest in the competitive grants, so you have lots more applicants than you make awards to?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crowe, yes. Anytime you have money on the table, usually the demand exceeds the supply.
Is there an appeals process?
We don't have any formal rules to do that. I don't know we've ever had an appeal that's come up.
When a county doesn't get a grant that it applies for, is there some explanation as to why, or just competitive ones probably?
We have
not.
Criteria, and all these are done in a public meeting, so if they want to hear the discussion or get an explanation, we always provide that.
I think it might be helpful to give them a little background as to why we think the grant administration is better now than it was prior to centralizing everything with the commission. Because I get asked often, is there a better way to fund these grants? Is there a more efficient way? And I guess I don't know that anybody really has a total what the history is and what it's improved by where we are now.
Well, again, prior to last session, the federal grants were located in the Commission on Children and Families, where they were part of the entire planning and other grant streams that the commission has that deals with kids from 0 to 18. And so this was, I would say, part of a much broader range of responsibility across a broader range of children and dealing with many different constituency groups. The grant program, the general fund grants that go to each county, were established to deal with primarily with adolescents, 10 to 17 year olds. These juvenile crime prevention grants basically deal with that population, and so we're transferred to, so they would dovetail better with what we're doing now. We're using the general fund grants primarily to provide direct services to either juveniles who are offenders and in the juvenile justice system or are at risk of becoming involved in the juvenile justice system or penetrating deeper into the juvenile justice system. And we're trying to structure these federal grants so they provide more systems approaches to cover some of the risk factors that we deal with, alcohol and drug, how we better connect with schools, targeting at-risk youth there. Obviously, anytime you create a grant program, you can there's a variety of agencies that you can house it in. And the Commission on Children, again, there's been, I'd say, more a focused approach with the Commission on Children and Families dealing with a younger age population so they can focus their efforts and deal more closely with a smaller group of constituents. We have more of the adolescent population. OIA deals with the offender population. And anytime, you know, they heard arguments last session on putting it in a number of different places, and you obviously have that choice. But what we're doing is focusing on prevention rather than the incarceration and the adjudication part of the system. And so I think it's very important to have that separate focus that really keeps that emphasis. And one of the things we'll talk about tomorrow is the waiver process by which we allowed some counties to take their prevention funds and use them for basic services or vice versa. And we wanted to have a flexible system and kind of see how it worked out. But this biennium, this coming biennium, we will be narrowing that waiver process. So it's going to be much more difficult for counties to take basic service or prevention money and use those for basic services.
For the
thank you.
For the $4 million federal funds, is there a requirement that we are matching that some way to get that $4 million?
Mr. Chair, Representative Doyle, the state does provide some match for the salaries for the two positions. I believe last biennium was about $70,000, so it's a little more than that. As far as the match to receive the grants, it varies by grant stream to grant stream. Many of them, I think, have a 50% match. Others do not require a match, if I'm correct.
Senator Trump?
How do you keep this grant program working in such a way that there's a kind of seamlessness between what the children and family people are doing with the younger age kids and then this group of kids?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, we go to a lot of meetings. that's probably not a great answer, but one of the things that Senate Bill 5...
Start.
Coordinating takes an incredible amount of work, frankly, and it takes a real effort and a real commitment. And one of the things that Senate Bill 555 directed us to do was, again, to look at the planning processes, the evaluation processes, and really line those up to reduce the administrative workload and the planning workload that local counties have to go through to access all these kind of funds. What we had generally seen was the local Commission on Children and Families have a planning process, they report to the State Commission on Children and Families. The juvenile departments have a planning process, they report to the OIA. The local Alcohol and Drug Advisory Planning Committees do their plan and it goes to ODAP, mental health to mental health. But there wasn't a lot of coordination of that across the counties or, frankly, across the state level. And so one of the things that 555 was intended to do is to, while you can still do these individual plans, they need to come together and work with each other. And that goes at the state level and at the local level. And so at the local level, we do that by having planning requirements that say, has your local alcohol and drug planning committee reviewed your juvenile crime prevention plan? Has your local commission reviewed? Has your local public safety council reviewed? All these bodies are appointed by the Board of County Commissioners, and so what we're trying to do is make sure that there's coordination in that planning process, that they come together at a centralized point in the county, and then move up to the state where we also have a centralized look and can start identifying if there are holes or if there are redundancies and really work on that issue. And so we've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how we're going to get from here to there. And we have a steering committee for 555 that meets periodically that includes state and local people to talk about some of these issues and how we bring these issues to the county boards of commissions who are, you know, like you, have more issues than they can possibly keep a handle on. But we spend a lot of time really emphasizing that kind of coordination and trying to reduce the redundancies and the duplicate planning requirements so we can make this process more efficient.
I've got a couple questions. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the minimum grants for counties. I think I was part of the planning before I got to the legislature, but I can't remember now whether 555, whether what's the level for the counties like Sherman and Wheeler and Dillon, that what level of support do they receive?
Mr. Chair, the minimum grant counties, again, the grant funds are divided up into two agency budgets. There's $13 million, or this current biennium, there's $13 million in the Criminal Justice Commission budget for prevention funds, $6 million in the OIA budget for basic services. And then basic services generally are juvenile department type services. So of those two pots, the basic services monies are distributed on a 0-17 basis period. So it's just like their diversion funds and other monies that they send out to the counties to help deal with their juvenile offender populations. It's a straight population-based piece. On the prevention money, obviously if you send $2,000 to a county, it's an awful lot to ask them to go through a planning process and do anything with high-risk juveniles who are going to get in the juvenile justice system with $2,000. And so as a result, the statute requires us to adopt a minimum grant. The level that we send to those counties is $50,000. So counties will get $50,000 on the prevention side and some additional funds on the basic services, and then plan for that money and coordinate it with the other funds that they get. In many of the minimum grant counties are in Eastern Oregon. They have a consortium of juvenile justice agencies and providers called COJAC. And so they work together not only within their counties but on a regional basis to regionally plan for those funds and work with the youth authority to develop those resources on a regional basis.
Can I ask a follow-up question on
that?
on those counties that are members of COJAC, how much total do those counties bring together under one?
I'm looking there. I don't have that number right with me. We can get that for you later today.
Follow. And I guess what I'd be interested in knowing is of that total pot, how much is spent on administration?
What we'd be able to tell you is the percentage of administrative funds that are requested in the grant. Any other administration that occurs through COJAC or staff that they have, we will not have access to. But just didn't get you that information.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is if we've got a baseline funding of 50,000 plus some additional of that, how much per county is being spent on administration? So how much is getting into the programs and services in our counties? And then I guess I'd be curious if there's another mechanism out there to administer these programs to save that administration expense. And now that I've stirred up the pot, I have to testify.
Zing, tabulate. Well, I'll begin my lengthy answer as you leave. We'll cover it while you're gone.
I'll listen to the tape. I'll be right back.
Unless there's other questions on juvenile crime prevention, I'll get back to the other program unit side that we were discussing earlier, Mr. Chair. The sentencing guidelines program, we talked about some of the performance measures we're considering and some of the factors affecting services. The interagency things that we do are the Criminal Justice Information Standards, which is the advisory board of state and local public safety bodies, including Department of Corrections, Judicial Department, state police, and LEDs, where we look at statewide public safety data issues and trying to get to a way that we can share information more readily. The uniform sentencing judgment we've talked about, and the crime bill corrections impact estimates. Funding for this program is entirely general fund except for the portion of the research analyst position which we fund with Statistical Analysis Center federal grant funds, which I'll talk about next. The Statistical Analysis Center, or SAC, is a $50,000 annual grant that the federal government gives to each state to support development and use of reliable criminal justice data. There are six authorized areas, and through our work with this committee over the years, we've generally used that for sentencing analysis and correction studies, so we use that to support two-thirds of the salary of our research analyst position. We have used some of the S&S portion of that to pay for the development and ongoing costs of our website. The other federal funds in the SAC area are the Measure 11 grant study funds, and I know that came up a little bit yesterday, so let me take a little bit of time to tell you what the purpose of that study is and where we are on it. National Institute of Justice had a gave us about a $310,000 grant to look at the system implementation issues involving Measure 11. It's not necessarily to look at the effectiveness or efficiency of Measure 11, but to provide a research-based study on what the impact on the criminal justice system was to have a voter-based initiative measure that really created a substantial change in how we did sentencing in Oregon. So what we're trying to do is look at reported crime, arrests, prosecutorial charging decisions, court timing, trial rate, who's going into prison now, how long they're staying, how that differs from how it was before. The difficulty in doing that is primarily centers around data and what we have available and what we can get. We have pretty good data on reported crimes. Basically, the state system data is in pretty good shape, and most of the problems we've had are technical, in that we asked for a data set, or the contractor on this is the RAND Corporation, so they're doing all the data receiving and number crunching, and then we work with them on that and on the local issues. We've had real problems over the last 2 years in getting the right data in the right format to set it up so we can match it up with other things we've got. It's taken us about three tries to get it out of Department of Corrections and out of OGIN to really get it so we can understand how the data is formatted, what we can compare across, and how we do that. And we're talking about a 10-year period, because we want to look at before Measure 11 passed, when it was implemented, and years occurring. And so that's been it's not been an easy process, and it's been a real source of frustration, because you know the information's there, it's just setting it up, and we want to make sure we're doing it right, because obviously this is a very important evaluation that we're doing. We think we're at the point now where we have good data sets from each of those major agencies, and we're getting ready to line those up and really start our analysis and hope to have that done by the end of the year. The other...
Sure.
Senator Trull.
Once you get that done, what value will that have? What will that do for us?
I think the biggest thing that will tell you, Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, the biggest thing will tell you is what happened if you took, for example, a 15-year-old with no prior criminal history who committed a robbery in the second degree. What happened to that person before Measure 11 passed? What typically happens after it passed? And how the system itself had to adjust to what is a major sentencing policy change. What I expect that we're going to find, obviously, is that we're going to have more kids, more juvenile offenders, age 15 to 17, being processed through the adult system. And at the same time, we set up the Youth Authority to deal with many of those youth. We're going to have changes in the trial rates. We're going to have, the major difference is going to be who serves how long and where they serve it. And we know that. One of the things that we'll be looking at is the ability of prosecutor offices to handle those cases, what charging decisions or changes in their charging and plea policies that appear to be made based on the data, and then we'll go back and work through the DA's offices to learn more about that. But it'll produce for the state and for the nation, because this is a federal study, when you make a dramatic change in your sentencing policy and then you do that through the ballot box, what some of the implications and consequences and policy decisions and actions that occurred as a result of that. And as you probably know from listening to the corrections forecasts over the years, we've learned a lot just in how we anticipate changes in the sentencing system in doing that. So it's just been such a huge policy issue, and still obviously if people want to look at it again on the ballot box, it's going to come up again. But
would you, when you say it's a federal study, how did we get so fortunate as to be the object of this study?
The RAND Corporation was involved in a national sentencing evaluation when the feds in, I believe, 94 passed the Violent Offender Truth and Sentencing Act that provided increased prison construction funds. Part of what they did was set aside some grant funds to study the impact of various sentencing reforms. RAND has the contract for that national evaluation study, and Multnomah County is one of their study sites. And so we worked with them and the University of Minnesota to develop basically a grant that would build on what they've done in Multnomah County. We added Marion and Lane County and worked with the DA's offices and the other players in the justice system, and they were interested in having this study done. And so we presented an application, got it funded, came through the e-board and got the approval to apply and receive the grant, and this is where we are.
By federal, the RAND Corporation helped me through this. Who's financing this?
The National Institute of Justice, Federal National Institute of Justice.
And they are supported by
these are federal tax grant funds? Yes, Senator.
Tax supported? And the RAND company is a group they've picked to analyze the data, or?
RAND Corporation had kind of a foot in the door because they're doing the violent offender evaluation nationwide, and we selected them to participate in this study with us and submitted an application and got that application approved.
With all of the different groups out there that study all kinds of things, why do we have confidence that RAND might come up with conclusions that are believable?
They have a long history.
Unbiased, I guess, would be.
They have a long history of evaluating criminal justice programs and are very highly regarded on a national basis. In addition, they already had, as I said, this foot in the door with the VOITAS evaluation, so we thought that they were ready to just kind of jump right in and help us do this.
And the other thing I'd ask you is, would you expect to be surprised by the results that this study demonstrates? Will the conclusions shock you?
I hope not.
I doubt if it will. That's just part of my skepticism about some of these studies and the money that is probably utilized in order to finance them, is that I think you probably know about everything that's going to be borne out by these studies, and we will have spent a lot of money to confirm what you think. And that's fine, I guess.
Well, Senator, I guess all I would say to that is if this assembly was willing to trust my judgment, my word on everything, I wouldn't spend as much time over here talking to you folks as I do. And so I think really that this, while I appreciate what I think is the confidence in my judgment and what we ended up finding out about this, it's different to have somebody, regardless of their experience, come in and tell you what we think we would find if we looked at this, as opposed to coming in, spending the time, looking at the information, processing it through the players, getting their reactions, and really giving you some good, solid conclusions. And that's what, you know, research is about. And we talk about evaluation. Tomorrow we come in and talk about the juvenile crime prevention money. You know, we can tell you that we think this is going to happen. It's going to have a beneficial effect on kids, and we can target the right kids. And what you told us is, that's very nice. We want you to do some evaluation and let us know what is actually happening.
Yeah, I guess I'm just kind of generalizing here. One of my concerns is that as we sit in other committees and hear about their needs and their budgets, we go through this exercise of trying to pick priorities. I'm struck by the fact that there are probably all kinds of organizations that wouldn't be taxpayer supported that could generate studies that will reach certain conclusions that probably help their cause. And I don't remember in the discussion of ballot measure 84, I guess it was, that I'm sure that both sides had all the evidence they wanted to present as to why measure 11 ought to be kept intact, and other people would develop all kinds of materials, I'm sure, to say why it was the worst measure ever adopted. And I'm not sure what another study is going to do for us, except cost money.
Well, Senator, I guess the other thing I would say is that we went through the same, one of the things that kept us very busy over the interim is that we had both Measure 3 and Measure 94, the forfeiture measure and the repeal of Measure 11.
With 94.
That we work with DAS on to develop an impact statement that goes in the voter's pamphlet. In Measure 94, we were able to obviously have a lot of data, and we had to make some pretty critical assumptions about what would happen if all these people went back and got resentenced, how long that would take, what kind of sentence they would get. And a lot of times we're, you know, best we can do is make an assumption, put that out for public discussion, let people debate it, and if we need to change it, we'll change it. If not, then we don't. On Measure 3, I thought we came up with some very supportable conclusions about what the fiscal impact of adopting that measure would be, and the price tag committee rejected it and said they didn't think there was going to be a fiscal impact. And we, frankly, we didn't have much data we could rely on, and so the, you know, I would say a little study would have helped in that measure. So it kind of comes and goes and really depends on who you're talking to and what their expectations are.
You know anything, again, kind of a fringe thing here, the Citizens Crime Commission in Portland, do you know how they're financed?
Mr. Chair, not a lot. They have, I believe most of it's by memberships. I don't know that there's any.
There's no public financing?
I couldn't say public, but I don't believe there's any state funds that go to.
I don't think there's state funds, but I'm kind of associated with the city of Portland.
Well, it's the Better Business Bureau. I don't believe they're associated with the city of Portland, per se.
Okay. I guess they just get a lot of attention up north. But it's, so far as you know, it's privately financed?
Yes.
So it's association of the business community.
I was involved in them a couple, three years ago on a project that they got private foundation funding for. But my recollection is that most of their operations are funded through memberships. But I haven't been real close to them for a couple of years, so can't.
All right. Thank you for that sidetrack stuff.
Want to just to close up with a couple little final things here on the Criminal Justice Policy Long Range Public Safety Plan. Again, we've kind of talked about the purpose of that and how we go about doing that. There's a new 1FTE position in the governor's recommended budget for that function. The other thing I would mention in that is that one of our statutory roles is supposed to be to support the local public safety coordinating councils that were established in 1995. And these are basically entities in every county that are consist of chiefs, sheriffs, judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, boards of county commissioners, mayors, city managers, to look at, to basically do a local public safety plan and how they allocate the resources, both state and local, for the public safety services in their county. Specifically, they do the 1145 planning, where the community corrections money goes to the counties, and that is the group that recommends how that money is spent to the Board of Commissioners and then to the Department of Corrections. Many of those counties do have professional planning staffs. I shouldn't say many, but the larger counties typically have professional planning staffs, and they do a lot of the analysis, how their system works, who's doing what, how they can make the system more efficient and effective. And the state really has lagged behind in supporting and encouraging that and broadening the basis of that outreach. And so that's another thing that I think this position would really be able to help us with, is to benefit from the existing planning efforts that are going on in the counties and bring those up into a statewide public safety plan. And to close out, we do have the forfeiture oversight issue that is a half FTE research analyst and about a $71,000 other fund expenditure. There's a 12-member oversight committee, three members appointed by the Senate president, three representatives appointed by the speaker, three by the governor, three by the attorney general. They look at data collection and analysis and provide a forum for policy discussions on the forfeiture law. Obviously, over the last about a year, we've been spending most of our time working on Measure 3 and what we think is going to come out of that. And the key issue here is that we don't expect that other funds to be there probably for at least a year. And so we'll need to figure out how we're going to fund that position. And again, the expectation from this body has been that that be more or less self-supporting using other funds, and we don't expect that to be there. Mr. Chair, I do have a little more information just outlining the essential packages in the budget note, but if you want me to continue that or have other obligations, I will cease and desist. I don't know what you're
talking about. Just on your page 15?
Yes.
Go ahead and highlight that if you wish.
The essential packages, the 010 just adjusts for vacancy factors. It's about a $6,000 reduction and $17,000 in general fund. Package 020 just again is we've been working on the Measure 11 grant and have spent those federal funds, and so that's the reduction on what we have spent. 030 is the inflation and price list, which is about $27,000, primarily in increases in state government service charges and professional services. 050 is a restores a one-time shift of $15,000 taken in the current biennium. What we did was, because we had the commission had an increased administration responsibility in the grant that we had anticipated in the original budget, we have requested authority from the feds to transfer $15,000 from a contract provider to the commission to help fund our administrative activities. And so this recognizes that that was a one-time shift that we were able to do, and returns that funding to us. The 090 is a reduction package that, again, those are the two position classifications that in combination save about $12,000 in general fund, and one's a put and one's a take, and so I think it's a little easier to understand those if we work them together so you can see the total package. Again, the policy package is the new planner position. It's $141,000 in general fund, and we've talked about that. In terms of the budget notes and audit, the budget note we had last session was to ensure that we were putting an effort into completing the public safety plan. We appeared at 1E board to present a work plan on how we're going to get there. We came again late last year to talk about a progress report, and you have the plan on your desk. And there were no audits in 9901 to discuss.
All right. Are there questions? We thank you very much for your presentation this morning. See you tomorrow. Mr. Nicewinder, yes. Anything from you?
Just that we'll spend tomorrow on juvenile crime prevention and any other wrap-up questions that you might have in hopes that we could be at a work session on Thursday.
Yeah, I would note that Thursday, because of Friday being no session, no committee, so far as I understand it, we have a full Friday. I don't know how many items.
Thursday.
And we may, I don't know how full the schedule is Thursday, but that could restrict our time in here Thursday. So I guess as much as we can do tomorrow would be good.
Yes.
All right. Anything further to come before the committee? If not, we are adjourned.